Lecture 16, Aeschylus, Prometheus Bound.
In our last lecture, we entered the tragic vision of William Shakespeare in his play, The Othello. Othello is most certainly a great book by the definition we gave to great books. It has a profound theme. That theme is power, jealousy, but above all, love. Love as the motivating force of human action. And I hope every one of you has been in love to such a degree that you would do anything for that love. History has been made by great men and women undertaking tremendous tasks, making powerful decisions for the sake of love. You remember Mark Antony and Cleopatra and our famous Greeks and famous Romans. And we talked about the Duke of Windsor, the Prince of Wales, who gave up a throne for the love of a woman. The Duchess of Windsor called her autobiography, "The Heart Has Its Reasons." And it was love that propelled Othello to kill his wife. He loved not wisely, but too well. And it was love that propelled Iago, in his twisted mind, to poison the mind of his friend Rodrigo, to poison the mind of Othello, because of his love for power, his ambition. So love is a powerful force. And it is a theme that moves us every day. Whenever someone says to me, "Oh, the Othello, it's just like a soap opera." Well, that's what life is a soap opera. And our newspapers are filled with people who do bizarre things in the name of love. I don't suppose I can mention the lady who ran down somebody with her car 7 or 8 times because she was in love. Now, Shakespeare not only has a great theme, but his tragedies, his comedies, his historical plays are all written in the embodiment of noble language. Language so elevated that it makes our hearts sing, and at the same time so powerful that it influences the daily speech of people who perhaps never have read Shakespeare. In the Othello, we read about jealousy, the green-eyed monster. So noble language that lived, and yes, universality. Shakespeare has been translated into most of the languages of the world and can be performed today, can be put on film in such a way that it still speaks to each one of us. We compare Shakespeare in this lecture with the tragic vision of the Greek playwright Aeschylus in his play The Prometheus Bound, produced in 458 B.C. We have spoken of the Oresti of Aeschylus as we have spoken of the Bacchae of Euripides. We come again to the Greek plays, the tragedy, that characteristic cultural statement of the Athenian democracy. The great age of the Greek playwrights of Euripides, of Sophocles, and Aeschylus is coterminous with the Athenian democracy of the 5th century BC and its grand period of empire, based upon the notion of democracy, liberty to live as you choose, political involvement of the ordinary citizen. And having taken upon their shoulders the awesome responsibility of self-government, the Athenians sought to educate themselves for freedom by the drama. It was a civic duty to attend the drama. You received a stipend to attend the drama. And the Athenian tragedies provided for the Athenian citizens a public forum in which to consider the most profound questions of politics. They had contemporary references. They dealt with contemporary events. But they were set in the mythical past to show you that these issues are eternal, reverberating through history. The most profound mind of the ancient world, as Dante called him in the Divine Comedy, Aristotle gives us a definition of tragedy. He does it in his work, The Poetics, written at the latter part of the 4th century B.C., but reflecting his thought about the great playwrights of a century before, Sophocles, whom we admired most of all, Aeschylus, and Euripides. Aristotle defined a tragedy as the imitation of an action, complete, of great magnitude, and noble, performed, not narrated, in verse, with music and scenic effects, and the result of the poetry, the scenic effects, and the theme is to arouse in the audience feelings of fear and pity, and thereby achieve a catharsis of those feelings. An action great in magnitude. If a wino dies on the streets of New York, that's sad. It is not tragic. Tragedy happens to the great. It happens to a Prometheus, or it happens to an Oedipus. It happens to an Agamemnon. Because if a figure as powerful as an Agamemnon, or as wise as an Oedipus, can suffer such a total reversal of fortune, then how much more likely is it to happen to you? And that is what tragedy is about. It is about a reversal of fortune, a fall. And that is why you want that action to be complete. You want to know the end, because as the Greek understood, no one is happy until the end is known. You think you're happy right now, but you haven't seen the end. You may walk out right now and be run over by a truck. No one is happy until the end is known. Moreover, it is the action that causes the tragedy. Character is not the cause of the tragedy. Character is how you endure the tragedy that happens to you. But the tragedy comes about because of an action you have taken yourself, of your own self-will. Remember when we talked about the Oresteia and the Bacchae? This is not fate requiring you to do these things. You make the choice out of your own free will. Now, the gods may make it look tempting, but you make the choice to take the action. And Aristotle uses the word to describe such an action that is the same word used to describe the throwing of a javelin that misses the mark. And the action that brings about your tragedy is a well-intentioned action that has disastrous consequences, that misses the mark and involves your ruin and frequently the ruin of others, the innocent. And it is performed on the stage. In the time of Aeschylus, with three actors who wear masks, wear elaborate clothes, great high shoes, all of it to set you back from the action, to give it this majestic appearance. And watching this action in elaborate poetic language that would essentially have the effect of the, let's say, the King James Version upon us today. That is to say, you hear it, you can understand most of it, but it is sufficiently distant that you have to ponder it and think about it. And the drama arouses in you the feelings of fear and pity. You are made afraid of what has happened to Agamemnon, or to Orestes, or to Pentheus and Bacchae. You fear it could happen to you, and you pity. You feel sorrow. And by having the feelings of fear and pity aroused in you, you achieve a catharsis. You know what a catharsis is. It's when you eat too many prunes, for example. It purges you, and it cleanses you, so that you can then make rational decisions. The theme of the Prometheus Bound is power. It is the abuse of power that is tyranny. The Athenians knew about tyranny. They feared tyranny. They had, in fact, been ruled by a tyrant in the 6th century B.C., Pisistratus, and by his son, Hippias. And they had driven that last tyrant, Hippias, out. They had made themselves a free people. They would not be ruled by a dictator, but it was always lurking there. Winston Churchill defined a tyrant as a person who believes that his own comfort, his own ideas, his own policy is worth the lives of millions. Does that not define an Adolf Hitler? That his racial ideas were worth the lives of 6 million people? Does that not define a Joseph Stalin who believed that his ideas about communism were worth 20 million people suffering? So tyranny is the abuse of power. The play was put on in the year 458, and Athens had just gone through a tremendous political transformation. The Athenians of 490 who had won at Marathon, the Athenians of 480 and 479 who had defeated the Persians again, they were a democracy. But like our own democracy, they were based upon a balance. There was a Supreme Court, and that Supreme Court could overturn decisions made by the assembly of the Athenian people. In 461, the great political leader Pericles, whom we so admired in our famous Greeks, led the Athenians in a series of policies that dismantled the Supreme Court, stripped it of its powers. And from that time onward, there was no check upon the power of the Athenian assembly. They were absolutely supreme. And Pericles also led the Athenians in a fundamental change in foreign policy. For up until that time, since the war with the Persians a generation before, Athens had been joined in a coalition with Sparta. Now, under the leadership of Pericles, Sparta was challenged, and Athens set out to become the absolute number one power in the Greek world. Both the balanced constitution and the foreign policy of cooperation with Sparta had been supported by Cimon. Cimon, a great general, a loyal Athenian and a patriot, who had conferred enormous benefits upon the Athenian people, helping them win their empire of the sea. And now, in the aftermath of the dismantling of the Supreme Court, Cimon was ostracized. That is to say, by a vote of the Athenian people, even though he had committed no crime whatsoever, he was sent into exile for 10 years. That was the injustice of a democracy. And Aeschylus, in his Prometheus Bound, is certainly speaking to this new political situation at Athens. And he is warning the Athenian people that a majority can be just as tyrannical as one man, and they can carry out the same wrong, unjust actions. But it is a theme that reverberates through history. And thus Aeschylus sets his drama in the very distant mythological past. In fact, in the days in which Zeus, king of the gods and king of men, had just come into his power. Because, you see, Zeus had not always been king of gods and men. There had been a time before. In fact, the first king of the gods was heaven, Uranus. And he had been overthrown by his son, Cronus, who emasculated his father and rose to power. And Cronus himself was then overthrown by his son, Zeus, with the other children of Cronus, with Hera, with Athena, with Apollo, with Hermes, with Hephaestus, rose up and overthrew their father, the great god Cronus. And a mighty war was fought. There came to the aid of Cronus that ancient race of the Titans, a gigantic race, brothers like Atlas fighting alongside Typhon and other of the Titans. And in a mighty war, the new gods, the gods of Zeus, triumphed. And essential to their triumph was the aid of one of the Titans, Prometheus, who at the critical moment went over to the side of Zeus, giving him the key to victory. Oh, and severe had been the punishment of those who had fought against Zeus. Atlas, the brother of Prometheus, was banished to the far corners of the universe. there to bear upon his shoulder for all eternity the world, laboring without end. Others had been thrown down into the pit and chained up. And Zeus now ruled, the new tyrant. And Prometheus, who had aided Zeus in this critical struggle at the critical moment, was at first honored. But you know, a successful tyrant must be suspicious. If you're going to be a successful leader, you have always got to be on the watch for that person who's plotting to overthrow you. Why, that person may not even know that they're plotting to overthrow you, but you do. How do you think Joseph Stalin lived to be an old man and die in bed? He always knew who was plotting against him. And Prometheus was a dangerous man. In fact, he had shown his dangerousness, his intrepid qualities, by going against an order of Zeus. Zeus had tired of the human race. They're a pitiful group when you come to think about it. And like other gods in history, he decided to get rid of them. Remember in the Old Testament, God is going to get rid of the human race by sending a flood. And we talked in the Gilgamesh about the gods Enlil and the others sending a great flood to destroy the human race. Well, Zeus is going to get rid of them. But Prometheus intervenes and saves humanity by bestowing upon them the arts and sciences that enable them to cultivate the divine and protect themselves. And he gave to the human race, Prometheus did, everything that made them reasoning creatures. He taught them how to grow crops. He taught them how to write so that information could be transferred from one generation to another. He taught them how to read the signs, the oracles, so that they could understand what the gods wanted and intended to do. He taught them how to offer up sacrifices to the gods, and even did it in such a smart way that the people, the humans, got to keep the meat that they offered up to the gods, burning on the altar only the hides and the hoofs and the fat. Taught them medicines to cure themselves. Taught them how to sail the sea and domesticate the wild animals. So he defied the will of Zeus. And the next thing you've got to learn as a leader is if anybody defies you, they must be punished. And our play opens then with Zeus carrying out the punishment of Prometheus, whose very name means foresight. Prometheus could see everything that was going to happen. And that makes him even more of a tragic figure. To know what is going to happen and to go right ahead and do it. He knew that if he helped the human race, he would be punished. But he went ahead and did it. And so at the beginning of the play, we are far out on the eastern fringe of the Greek world, in the Caucasus Mountains. And there Prometheus is being crucified by the personification, the god Power, and by the god Hephaestus, the god of fire and of craftsmen. I'm sorry to have to do this. Get on with the task and nail him and crucify him. I'm sorry, Prometheus. I wish I didn't have to do this. You've got the good cop and the bad cop, don't you see? Hephaestus and Power. If it were up to me, I wouldn't do it. Just get on with the job, says Power. This is not our business. Crucify him. I'm sorry. And the nails are driven into the hands of Prometheus, spread eagle there on a mountaintop. And the pain is all but unendurable. Yes, that's just how it always is, he says. You're sorry you have to do it, Prometheus says, but you're doing it. That's how a tyrant carries out his evil. You'll notice Zeus is not out there doing it. No, he's safe and secure in his great palace. But he always finds people like Power and like Hephaestus, to do the work for him. And you say you're sorry, and you say you're just following orders, but you still do it. That's how tyranny works. It's evil. Look, Hephaestus, why don't you apologize to Zeus? He will let you go. I will not apologize to him, for I have done nothing wrong. I will take any punishment he gives me, but he will not break my spirit. You're a real hardhead. Drive those nails on in and get it over with. Well, the chorus is the daughters of the great ocean. And they are there weeping and moaning. We feel so sorry for you, Hephaestus. We feel so far sorry for you, Prometheus. Why don't you just give in to Zeus and get all this suffering behind you? I don't need your pity. You are helpless. And I will never give in to him. For I am right and he is wrong. And there is an absolute scale of right and wrong. Tyranny is wrong. To kill the human race is wrong. To do kindness is right, and that is what I did. Who is that cow coming here to the far reaches of the Caucasus? I know her, says Prometheus. It is Io, that poor, unfortunate victim of Zeus's tyranny. You know, a tyrant doesn't just want power. He wants all the things that power brings with it, like women. Why can't he have any woman he wants? And there was Io, a maiden, a virgin, beautiful. And Zeus says, I want you. But I don't really want you. Dad of Io, father of her, I want her. I think probably you better let him have you, daughter. But I don't want to be with Zeus. You're going to be with him. And so she was. But then Zeus, like every tyrant, he's a coward. Joseph Stalin at heart was a coward. And Zeus is afraid of his own wife, Hera. So when she gets outraged, when she finds out about his infidelity with Io, she punishes her. The woman is turned into a cow, Io is, and followed everywhere by a stinging gadfly. A great horsefly. Let one of them bite you while you're out on your walk or your jog. They are vicious things. And it follows her everywhere she goes. She can find no rest. And to make sure her punishment continues, a god with many eyes follows her around as well. So all over the world she roams. Just because Zeus wanted a dalliance, a few moments of pleasure. Now what happens to her, he doesn't care. And Io comes there, and Prometheus can see into the future, and he says, your suffering will go on year after year after year. Don't tell me that. Why? I must tell you the truth. It will go on year after year after year after year. You will be punished. But one day, from those children you have brought forth, from those who sprung from Zeus himself, there will come a Savior who will deliver me. Hercules will be born of your descendants and will one day come to help me. But in the meantime, go on your way to the far corners of the earth in suffering and in torment, one more victim of the tyranny of Zeus. But you know something? Prometheus says to the chorus, who is still there, the daughters of the ocean, moaning and weeping, don't weep too much for me. Weep some for Zeus. For Zeus? Why should we weep for Zeus? He is king. Might not always be king. What do you mean? Nothing? Your pain is making you talk crazy. No, it's not. I can endure my pain. Zeus can be overthrown, and I know how he can be overthrown, and I know who will try to overthrow him. Ooh! They're the informers, of course. Almost immediately, Zeus hears about this. Wait a minute! I've got to find this out! So thus comes the god Hermes, messenger of the gods. Hi, Prometheus, I'm sorry to do this to you. No, you're not. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it. Look, power is a mighty thing. I do not give the orders, I just follow them. And I'm going to tell you one thing, if I didn't do it, I, Hermes, somebody else would do it. And I don't want to end up like you. You're the hard head. All you had to do was not help the human race. Or having helped the human race, you could have apologized to Zeus, perhaps, and made your punishment less. But no, you're right. What in the world is right? Right is what power says it is. If you've got the power, you say what is right or wrong. Isn't that absolutely true? Yes. Now, let's just put that aside because you've got one more chance to help yourself. Tell me who is going to overthrow Zeus. No. Now, I'm telling you, this is getting serious. You think you're in pain now, having been nailed to a mountain? Do you know what Zeus has got in store for you? He is going to singe every day a horrible earthquake with lightning to shake the ground. And then, every day, an eagle is going to fly down, the bird of Zeus, and he's going to eat your innards. He's going to eat your liver. And every night it'll grow back. And then the next day the thunder and lightning will come and the eagle will come down and eat your liver again. And that will go on for all eternity. Now, do you want that to happen to you? Why multiply your suffering? Tell Zeus to do anything he wants to me. I will not tell him. Torture me. I will not tell him. Now, isn't that the eternal spirit of the revolutionary speaking out? Do anything you want. You will not break my spirit. You will not make me tell you what you want. This is a big mistake that you're making. Go ahead. Send everything you can down upon me. And that is how the play ends, with thunder and lightning off the stage, and Prometheus shrieking his defiance to Zeus, send it down and destroy me. I don't care. You will not break me. The power of a Zeus, unhampered by law, the power of a tyrant able to inflict human suffering on a colossal scale, able to inflict punishment even upon the gods and the divine. In 1984, when we discuss that great novel of George Orwell, we will see his eternal definition of power as the ability to inflict pain and humiliation. And that definition was as true in the 5th century of Athens as it was in Nazi Germany or in Stalin's Russia or as is today. There is nothing more terrible than simple pain, unrelenting pain. And there is nothing worse to our spirit than humiliation. Here is the Prometheus, who had been honored at the court of Zeus, now crucified and subjected to this constant agony and pain, all because of his belief in what is right. Now, the Prometheus Bound, with its powerful statement of the right to resist, because that's what it is about. Not only do you have a right to resist tyranny, you have a duty to resist tyranny. Where did you read that? You read that in the Declaration of Independence, did you not? It is their right, it is their duty to resist tyranny. That is the very law of nature. Your natural right is to stand up and to resist tyranny. That was the message of the Prometheus Bound. Now, you're sitting in a classroom in Germany in 1932. Your parents have great hopes for you. You're going to a classical gymnasium, a classical high school, and then you're going to go on to the university. You're going to become an attorney. And there are your teachers in the gymnasium having you read the Prometheus Bound. You go home at night to your quiet middle-class existence. Your father asks you around the table, what did you learn in school today? And you quote him a line or two of the Prometheus. Ah, what a wonderful, wonderful work that is. What an enduring statement of tyranny and its evils it is. And never do you once think that in a few years, your career path is going to lead you into the most rapid form of promotion in the SS. And you're going to be doing that same duty for a tyrant out on the steppes of Russia, carrying out the evil of a tyrant, because you're just following orders.